Thanks for checking out the Good Morning Hamilton podcast. I'm Rick Samprin. A criminal defense lawyer joins us to talk about appeals from two notorious killers. Allegations of anti-Semitism have plagued the Hamilton Center by-election. Election interference allegations have also hit Queen's Park. Is your confidence in the banking system shaken? Students use a video game to improve their stem cells, and it's the end of an era at Mohawk College. The GMH podcast starts now.
This is the Good Morning Hamilton podcast on 900 CHML.
Convicted killers Dellon Millard and Mark Smith. I don't even like saying their names, but we have to in this case because they are appealing their first-degree murder convictions and parole eligibility in the deaths of Ancaster's Tim Bosma and Toronto's Laura Babcock. And this is playing out in the Ontario Appeal Court. Here to talk about how this all works is John East. He's a Hamilton criminal defense lawyer at East Law and joins us now on Good Morning Hamilton. John, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. So why is this appeal happening now? What's changed?
Well, one of the things that has changed is a ruling from the Supreme Court of Canada in a case called Bissonnette, where the Supreme Court of Canada struck down a provision in the criminal code that gave the discretion to judges to stack on top of each other for multiple convictions of murder, of first-degree murder, 25-year periods of parole ineligibility. So, as I understand it, Mr. Millard was facing 75 years of parole ineligibility, and the co-accused in the Babcock murder, Mr. Smith, I think he was facing 50 years of parole ineligibility. So in the Bissonnette case, that was challenged to the Supreme Court of Canada. The Supreme Court of Canada held that because that law intrinsically closed the door on rehabilitation, that law in and of itself constituted cruel and unusual punishment, which was in violation of Section 12 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. They struck down that law and indicated that it had no force and effect, which now opens the door, so to speak, for anybody charged with multiple first-degree murders who were given consecutive 25-year segments of parole ineligibility, and they now have the ability to appeal those decisions.
I don't want to relitigate what the Supreme Court ruled, but I would say that, you know, Bosma and Babcock also suffered cruel and unusual punishment, and that should trump any sort of rights, I would say, that Millard and Smith would face. But beyond that, what are the chances that they win this appeal? Is it very good because of what the Supreme Court has already ruled?
Well, as it relates to the parole ineligibility, I would say their chances are pretty good. The Supreme Court of Canada was very clear that that law was unconstitutional and violated the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So that being said, it's not as if they will automatically be granted parole after 25 years. They would still have to appear in front of a parole board. That parole board works as an administrative tribunal. They have to make the decision based on their conduct in jail, their prospects of rehabilitation. But as it relates specifically to the grounds of appealing on the basis of the parole ineligibility, their chances are good. Of course, there are other grounds of appeal that they have launched, and it's much more tough to say what their chances of success are on those fronts because those grounds are launched in absence of some overarching Supreme Court of Canada judgment and have to do with errors that the judge made at the lower court when the trial actually commenced.
An example of that is Mark Smith's lawyer is arguing that Mr. Smith was not involved in the murder of Laura Babcock, but was involved in other aspects of that crime. That would be the example of what you're referring to.
Yes, exactly. So Ms. Lipkowski, counsel for Mr. Smith, is arguing that there's no actual evidence that he participated in the planning or killing of Ms. Babcock. There is evidence that he participated after the fact to cover it up, and that was due, she says, to the power imbalance of the relationship. Mr. Smith relied on Mr. Millard supposedly for income. He lived at his house. And there were a number of pieces of evidence that she is using to launch that appeal. One of the pieces of evidence, as I understand it from secondary sources, is that the phones that the police tracked, Millard and Babcock's phones were tracked in tandem away from his home on the night that she disappeared. Smith's phone remained in the home. So that's one of the examples and pieces of evidence that the lawyer is using to say he was not involved in the killing. There were certainly other pieces of evidence that suggested, at the lower court at least, that he was involved after the fact. But as I said, the argument is that in terms of evidence that he was involved in the actual killing, the lawyer for Mr. Smith says that was lacking.
John, we got a minute. You know, most people, I think, are just wondering, are these two guys, Millard Smith, are they ever going to get out of prison via parole? Your best guess?
It's really hard to say, Rick. If they show good conduct over the next 25 years and they actually show legitimate prospects of rehabilitation, the chances are pretty good. But as I understand it, Mr. Millard, as of 2021, was charged, or maybe he was even convicted of an assault as it related to a conduct in his time at prison. So it doesn't sound like he's off to a very good start. That being said, if they show good behavior, if they can show that they have legitimate prospects of rehabilitation, then parole is granted with conditions.
Great information from John East, Hamilton criminal defense lawyer at East Law, also the host of A Winning Approach on CHML. You can hear that show on the fourth Saturday of each month from 11 until noon. John, appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rick.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast from 900 CHML.
Well, yesterday we had a new story about Elections Canada releasing figures about the advance polls for this Thursday's by-election in Hamilton Centre. As you know, Andrea Horvath, the former longtime MPP for Hamilton Centre and leader of the NDP, vacated that position after winning the mayoralship here in Hamilton. And so now a by-election is being held. And the advance poll numbers from Elections Canada, not too good. Just 5% of all registered voters in the riding went to advance polls to cast their ballots, about 4,100 voters. And that is way less than the 11% who did so during the 2022 general election. So the interest in the election, obviously with these numbers, not that high. And who knows whether it's going to get higher or lower following the latest story. And that is that B'nai B'rith issued a statement yesterday accusing NDP candidate Sarah Jama of anti-Semitism, which she denies, calling her a radical activist who has been associated with groups that have frequently targeted Israel. That's a direct quote from B'nai B'rith. And now this organization is calling on the NDP and its leader, Marit Stiles, to drop Jama as a candidate. Let's bring in Kim Wright, founder and principal of Wright Strategies, to Good Morning Hamilton on 900 CHML. Kim, welcome back. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm great.
This sounds kind of messy.
Yeah, it is always going to be messy when you have these type of things, these type of statements and these types of accusations. But let me be very clear. Anti-Semitism is absolutely abhorrent and cannot be tolerated. And Sarah Jama herself, the New Democrat candidate, has said that she has no anti-Semitic feelings and believes in a peaceful two-state solution, which sounds an awful lot like what B'nai B'rith has called for in the past and others. So I think what we're seeing here is the last few days of a campaign, people having questions about different candidates, and that's fine. But what I've seen from Marit Stiles, from Sarah Jama, from the New Democrats, is an ongoing commitment to address anti-Semitism that has been rising across the province and across the country. And they've actually taken it upon themselves, the Ontario New Democrat Caucus, to do anti-Semitism training to all caucus members. And that's an ongoing conversation. That's an ongoing training, as we're seeing in many workplaces. And you're really making sure that people understand the history as well as what they can do as legislators and public servants. So I think that this is one of those very unfortunate late in the campaign conversations that unfortunately, Rick, to your point, might deter some people coming up to vote. I'm not sure that that was the intent of B'nai B'rith, but certainly that may end up being where we're at.
My best guess is this won't have a huge impact on how people vote, if they even bother to go out and vote. I would think at this time of the by-election run, people have made up their mind. Do you think this is at all going to have an impact on how people cast their ballots?
What I know is that in by-elections, it's about how you connect with your voters. And what I've seen from Sarah Gemma and her campaign team is they've been out on doorsteps, they've been out at transit stops, they've been out everywhere they can to meet voters where they're at and try to encourage them to get out to the polls to introduce themselves to Sarah. And many Hamiltonians will have known her through her various activism over the years, including with the Hamilton Anti-Racism Center. So what we're seeing is the last couple of days of the campaign trying to find ways to get those last voters to the ballot box. And as we've seen in the last couple of campaigns, not only in by-elections, but in the general elections, getting people out to vote is very complicated. And hopefully the voter turnout will be better than we've seen in the past.
There's been a lot of talk over the last number of weeks about foreign interference in our elections. Do you think that's top of mind for voters?
I think it's a concern for every Canadian and Ontarian and Hamiltonian. I think when you've heard these headlines about how is it impacting local campaigns, I think it's cause for concern. And I think that's why the Prime Minister should call a public inquiry and get to the bottom of what has happened. I don't think you're seeing that type of foreign interference at play in this by-election. But what you are seeing are people trying to figure out who are these candidates? How do they get involved? And what I've seen out of the Gemma campaign has been a really positive approach to getting people involved in politics. There's been a lot of people coming in and out of the campaign office, and hopefully that translates to her election on Thursday.
A couple more minutes with Kim Wright, founder and principal of Wright Strategies on Good Morning Hamilton on 900 CHML. This has been an NDP stronghold in Hamilton Centre for years. Is this going to be a massive loss if Sarah Gemma cannot pull it off?
Oh, I think what we're seeing is people are very excited about Sarah Gemma's campaign. And as I said, we're seeing that on the doorstep. We're seeing that in the campaign office. We're seeing that in a lot of places. So, but the most important thing is, with voter turnout being in those sort of 20 to 30% range, every vote does actually matter. So if you're listening and you're like, it's always the new Democrats that always win it, I don't need to show up, I'll tell you this, you absolutely should show up, because I've seen campaigns that have been won and lost by as little as 9 votes. So you'll want to get out there and make sure your candidate wins.
Kim Wright, founder and principal, Wright Strategies, always appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I should also mention that NDP candidate Sarah Gemma was invited for an interview yesterday with Scott Thompson on Hamilton Today, but canceled that interview. And a reminder, Election Day is this Thursday. The polls in the Hamilton Center by-election will be open from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. And we will, of course, have all the results for you later that night, certainly on social media and on the air, and all the reaction the next morning here on Good Morning Hamilton on 900 CHML. It's going to be interesting to see how this unfolds. And as I mentioned, this has been really an orange NDP for eons. And even before the time of Andrea Horvath, this has been an NDP stronghold in Hamilton Centre. Will it change on Thursday, or will it remain the same? That remains to be seen.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast from 900 CHML.
We will ask the independent special rapporteur, as one of the first tasks of their mandate, to provide the government with a recommendation as to what the appropriate next step should be, whether it be an inquiry, an investigation, or a judicial review, and what the scope of that work may be.
Welcome back to Good Morning Hamilton on 900 CHML, the voice of our Prime Minister appointing a special rapporteur to recommend how the government should tackle the issue of foreign interference in our elections. It's been a hot topic over the last number of weeks, and it's also reached out to Queen's Park. There's an Ontario MPP by the name of Vincent Kah, who has resigned from the Ontario PC caucus amid election interference allegations. What is going on? Let's ask Colin DeMello, Queen's Park Bureau Chief with Global News, who joins us now on GMH. Colin, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
How has Mr. Kah become entangled in this alleged election interference?
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the excellent series of reporting that comes from Sam Cooper, who's really been leading the way on a lot of this investigative journalism related to election interference, and, you know, with some ties to China. Vincent Kaye has been accused of accepting $50,000 or being given $50,000 as part of this network of individuals who were taking money from the Toronto Chinese consulate and using them for election interference. Now, exactly how this money gets dispersed and where it goes and how it kind of gets deployed in elections, that is still kind of a bit of a mystery. But this is all coming from, you know, the Canada spy agency, CSIS, which was kind of doing a little bit of digging into whether or not there was a network of operatives in Canada that were, you know, using any kind of illicit funds that may have been coming from mainland China to influence elections in Canada. And this all has to do with the 2019 election and some 11 candidates who may have either wittingly or unwittingly been a part of this network of interference. And Vincent Kaye has been accused of being one of these people who was an intermediary when it comes to some of the funding for this entire scheme.
Vincent Kaye recently stepped out of the caucus, now sitting as an independent, but I was watching Global News at 5:30 and 6 last night, and you spoke to him back in December about this.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting kind of series of events because, you know, you have to take a look at what happened on Friday. On Friday, the initial Global News story had come out sometime in the mid-morning. And in that story, the Premier's office had a very vocal defense of Vincent Kaye. They said that, you know, he was kind of an instrumental member or an important member of the Ontario Progressive Conservative Caucus. Then suddenly that evolved not long after the story came out. The Premier announced that he was reshuffling the decks in his cabinet. Vincent Kaye was a junior cabinet minister, and he was part of a ministry that really dealt with some sensitive data, open data portals in Ontario, Service Ontario. So there could have been access to some data. And he got demoted right away because the government saw the story come out and realized they had to react. By that evening, Vincent Kaye had, you know, offered his resignation from the Ontario PC caucus to the Premier, and the Premier had accepted. So that is a dramatic evolution over the, you know, course of about 24 hours or less than that. But the question is, what did the Premier know? When did he know it? And why didn't he act sooner? And in fact, you know, Global News had been asking Vincent Kaye questions all the way in early December about whether or not he had been part of this influence network. In fact, the very first story that Sam Cooper had published came out in about mid-November, and that had mentioned an Ontario MPP being part of this network. And the rumor mill was abuzz, but everyone had, you know, narrowed it down to one individual, Vincent Kaye, just, you know, based on their own suspicions. But the government certainly was aware of those, you know, suspicions or rumors, but the Premier's office didn't do anything about it. So that will be a question that the government faces, right? If you were concerned enough about Vincent Kaye to demote him from cabinet in March, why didn't you do it in December when you were first made aware of, you know, even some of the stories that were going to come out? What happened in that ensuing period of time, and why didn't the Premier act sooner?
It's a very good question. Colin DeMello is our guest on Good Morning Hamilton on 900 CHML. Colin is the Queen's Park Bureau Chief for Global News. You can check him out on Global News at 5:30 and 6. With this special rapporteur looking at foreign interference, alleged foreign interference in our elections, does that now spread out to Queen's Park?
Well, that's certainly what the Ontario NDP wants to see happen, right? Here at Queen's Park, there's very few mechanisms to really start looking into election interference, right? We don't have the same level of committees and the same level of national security and intelligence that the Parliament Hill would have access to. So the Ontario NDP is largely relying on the federal government to call a public inquiry. Of course, there is that special rapporteur that the Prime Minister has appointed to take a look into what the next steps should be. But the Ontario NDP says, listen, it should be sweeping, it should be broad, and it should cover Ontario politicians and Ontario politics as well. Now, just so everyone knows, I reached out yesterday to Elections Ontario to ask them if they had any concerns about the 2018 or the 2022 election. And Elections Ontario said, first, if they do have complaints or if they start an investigation, they typically don't let members of the public know, so we wouldn't know about it. But additionally, they said that they were fairly confident in the systems and the outcomes of the 2018 and the 2022 election. So Elections Ontario doesn't seem to have concerns about Ontario's the past two elections in this province. So now the question is, you know, if there will be a public inquiry, will Ontario be included? And, you know, what level of cooperation will the Ford government have? Because remember that that public inquiry into the Emergencies Act, the premier chose not to participate at all.
Fascinating story with a lot of layers. And Colin, we're glad you're here with us today to explain some of the ramifications. Thanks for your time today. Enjoy the rest of the day.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Colin DeMello, Queen's Park Bureau Chief at Global News. Check him out at Global News at 5:30 and 6.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast from 900 CHML.
As you've been hearing in the news, a lot of news about these two banks, Silicon Valley Bank in California and Signature Bank in New York, both largely focusing on business customers with digital assets. Well, they both collapsed in the last week, and now governments are really doing all they can to reassure other banking customers that everything's okay. You're going to get your money. Don't worry. We will make things work. I mean, easier said than done. If you are a fund holder and you have money in one of these two banks, and you're thinking, can I get my money? Where is it? Is it easily accessible? And this is making international news as well, not only just in the U.S., of course. Canada's looking at this situation to say, all right, how does it impact us? The superintendent of Canada's financial institutions temporarily seizing assets of the Canadian branch of Silicon Valley Bank to protect the rights and interests of the branch's creditors. And over in the U.K., the U.K. Treasury has arranged the sale of the British branch of this failed California bank to HSBC. And we heard from the Treasury chief in Britain, Jeremy Hunt, who said that the SVB bank branch in the UK is relatively small, but it does play an important role in Britain's economy.
A number of our most promising and important technology and life science companies had their money with Silicon Valley Bank in their UK branch. So we've been working over the weekend. I've been in constant contact with the Governor of the Bank of England, the Prudential Regulatory Authority, the Prime Minister, to work up a solution.
So what's the deal here in Canada? What kind of impact are we expecting to see? Anne Gaviola, senior digital broadcast journalist with Global News, who's been following the story extensively, joins us now on Good Morning Hamilton. Anne, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's great to be here. Wish it was under some more cheerful circumstances.
Yeah. Most people are asking, how does this sort of thing happen? How did the collapse occur?
Let's talk about these two banks. There was Silicon Valley Bank. It was based in California. It served mainly a tech community. And these are our tech companies, a lot of them just getting off the ground, so not quite found a path to profitability. And they were getting squeezed by rising interest rates. So what they were having to do to go about their day-to-day operations was pull money and make payroll, pull money out of SVB, Silicon Valley Bank. To honor these withdrawals, SVB was having to sell off a big bunch of its bond portfolio at a loss. These were long-term U.S. Government bonds, and they had dropped in value with rising interest rates, so they were getting squeezed too. They had to sell off a bunch of their stock to meet these demands, and investors saw that. They got really nervous. They pushed SVB's stock price down as well. And it just kind of snowballed from there. There was a good old-fashioned bank run, and too many people tried to pull their money out of SVB at the same time. Within 48 hours of these things that I mentioned coming to light, this is a bank that had collapsed, had been taken over by U.S. regulators, and that happened on Friday. And then there's another bank kind of at the center of this. It's a domino effect, if you will. This happened on Sunday to Signature Bank, which is based in New York. It primarily served a crypto community, and U.S. regulators took a look at what was going on there and said, ugh, it's really close to the edge. They swooped in and they proactively shut it down. So yeah, these two banks going under in 3 days, this is important too, because, you know, U.S. officials, what they did is they created a fund to help depositors at these banks that I mentioned, or any others that may be having trouble, to kind of say, there's nothing to see here, folks. The U.S. banking system is safe and we've got you.
So the likelihood of a run at another bank is probably very remote.
Okay, I'm not a betting person. I wouldn't call it very remote.
Okay.
And here's the thing. I've been speaking to a bunch of analysts. The landscape in the U.S., and these are two regional banks that I'm talking about. So they're not the really, really big ones, but they're concentrated in, you know, these states, California and New York. And they're governed by regulation that is less strict than some of their bigger counterparts, and certainly than what we have here in Canada. In fact, the rules overseeing them were made less strict back in 2018 under U.S. President Donald Trump. And there are a whole lot of these regional players in the U.S. Analysts tell me that, you know, it would not be surprising to see many others struggling and maybe even going under. The fact is, you know, one analyst says there are too many of these, and so this is probably due.
We've got about a minute. What does this mean for banks on this side of the border?
Really good question. I know a lot of people are nervous. Could this happen here in Canada? Like I said, it's a very different landscape in terms of the banking system and how many banks they have in the U.S. versus here. What we have are a few well-capitalized, diversified banks. It's not to say that it couldn't happen here, but it is a whole other universe, so people should take comfort in that. In terms of SVB itself, it had one branch here in Canada. Canadian officials have taken it over, but it didn't hold any people or any companies' deposits. What it was doing here was lending money, so it is important to the tech community, but in terms of the impact, the wider impact, people should breathe a sigh of relief there.
Great information, Anne. Thank you for your time today. Enjoy the rest of the day.
You bet.
That is Anne Gaviola, senior digital broadcast journalist with Global News. U.S. President Joe Biden just reassuring Americans that the country's financial systems are sound after these two banks collapsed. We'll pay attention to this for sure over the next days and weeks.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast from 900 CHML.
Some students at a middle school in Depew, New York, tested their STEM skills by spending their lunch and study hall time to design the new Buffalo Bills Stadium using Minecraft. So I caught a tweet about a week or so ago, which read, a bunch of my middle school kids have been coming in during lunch and study hall to design the new Buffalo Bills Stadium from essentially two renderings in Minecraft. Cool to incorporate the biggest construction project in Western New York with STEM and Minecraft. That tweet was sent out by Aaron Nolan, a technology and engineering teacher at Depew Middle School, and our guest now on Good Morning Hamilton on 900 CHML. Aaron, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. How did this all come about?
It was what I call a happy little accident. So basically, a couple years ago, I took a training in Minecraft for education, and I didn't really see how I could apply it to what I wanted to do in my engineering curriculum because we had so many other resources. So the one day, a couple of kids were in my CAD lab, and they saw Minecraft for Education on the desktop, and then it just spread like wildfire. We were in there playing around. I didn't know much about it at first, and it was kind of a unique learning experience for me, learning from my students. And then one student just said, we should make the Bills field, and then that spiraled into, we should make the stadium. Well, that spiraled into, we should make the concourses. We should make the locker rooms. It just was such a cool experience to see the kids take something that wasn't planned and run with it.
How many students got involved in this?
So probably about a little over a dozen, maybe 12, 15 kids used were coming in during lunch and study hall. So our district has me purposely plan periods off during those times to get the kids incorporated into more STEM-based stuff that kind of is more wide open and conducive to what they want to learn. So I'm pretty fortunate to be in that type of situation.
So how did using Minecraft to build the new Buffalo Bills Stadium, and again, as I mentioned in your tweet, they were using two renderings to do this. How did they use their STEM skills and Minecraft to make this venue?
So it's kind of a cool experience. You know, I believe that, first of all, sports are unifying. You know, you take a look at what happened in the hockey game last night when the national anthem, Mike cut out and you know, the great people of Toronto sang the Star Spangled Banner. And, you know, I believe in Buffalo here, the Bills are the single most unifying force in our community. You know, everyone's involved, especially with the success they had lately with, you know, Josh Allen and all that. But, you know, we just kind of took it. We looked at two renderings because everyone's getting antsy, wanted to see more and more of the stadium that was going to be being built. And we just kind of took it. You know, we focused a lot on scale and visualization and design and, you know, the whole like XYZ and three-dimensional thinking. And the kids just kind of took basically took it on their own and just kind of figured things out, which I was super proud of them.
What was the biggest challenge? Because once you have the field, my guess is it would be a little easier to build the stadium. How did they figure out some of the hiccups that occurred?
You know what? It was just perseverance. I guess if you were to talk to the students, they'd say the hardest part is the angled roof we put on the top of it. But, you know, when you compare what they were able to do in a Minecraft world with the actual renderings that we were using, it is pretty close. It is pretty spot on. I think they nailed the scale of it. And, you know, the teamwork that they had within the game itself, you know, working back and forth, and the drive and motivation and camaraderie just seeing them push each other to the next spot was pretty unique to see.
That is pretty awesome. Aaron Nolan is our guest on Good Morning Hamilton on 900 CHML. Aaron is a technology and engineering teacher at DePue Middle School in Western New York. His students built the Buffalo Bills' new stadium using a couple of renderings and Minecraft, a popular video game that a lot of the young kids are playing and have been playing for at least a couple decades now. What feedback did you get from the kids?
They want to keep doing more. You know, they wanted to know what's next. You know, it's something that inspired me as a self-reflection piece to see how I can use it more in a classroom. And, you know, I know there's other things we can do, like some coding and other things with it. But I'm definitely going to look into seeing how I can incorporate Minecraft more in the classroom, because it is engaging for the kids. Actually, I've surprised her, not surprised, but I've kind of realized it's a motivational tool for the students who are struggling too, where I kind of, you know, as a mentor said, you know, if you want to come in during lunch and study hall, we got to get your grades up. And they're like, give me 2 weeks. And 2 weeks later, their grades are way up from what they were. So it's a great motivational tool that I'm continuing to try to implement in my curriculum.
When did this all first start, and how long did it take to complete this stadium project?
So we, like I said, we worked on it for about two periods a day. Probably took us about 6 weeks. So it was quite of a labor intensive process, but it was well worth it.
What were some of the lessons learned? Because you mentioned camaraderie, and I would think that teamwork and working together and, you know, kind of delegating who's doing what would be a big takeaway.
Oh, that for sure. You know, just those communication skills, the ability to work on something together. You know, that, and in addition to all the STEM skills that they're building, just the people skills and the planning and the layout of, you know, how to delegate other things. Like, people are asking, all right, that job's done, what can I do next? And just, it was kind of seeing that, you know, they work together as a cohesive unit. It was really, really awesome experience.
Have you gotten any feedback from the team themselves and how the Bills feel about it?
Not yet. I know there's a local news outlet here in Buffalo that wants to do a piece on them. I'm fortunate enough to have one of my neighbors be a coach on the Bills, and I sent him the video. He's like, that is awesome. Tell him I appreciate it. So that was kind of cool to have the kids get feedback from him.
So. Obviously, as you mentioned, your kids are jazzed about this. So what's next? What are you building next using Minecraft?
So one of the girls wanted to do the Key Bake Center where the Sabres play. So, you know, it's like I said, it's, who knows what we'll do. You know, I'm all for anything they want to do. So it's a great, great experience for me. It's kind of refreshing too, to see the kids want to take the charge in what they want to do too.
And whenever you can get kids engaged in the classroom, that is a winning day. Aaron, thank you for your time. Congratulations with this, and we'll talk to you down the road.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Have a good day.
You too. That's Aaron Nolan, technology and engineering teacher at DePue Middle School. His kids, it took about 6 weeks or so to basically take two renderings of the Buffalo Bills' new stadium, used Minecraft to build this thing, field, locker rooms, concession stands, and everything else included in the stadium. It is pretty cool to see. Just Google Buffalo Bills Stadium Minecraft, and you'll see all the videos and photos that go along with it.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast from 900 CHML.
Well, after 18 years at the helm of the Mohawk College men's basketball team, it's the end of an era. Head coach Brian Jonker is calling it a career, and Brian joins us now on Good Morning Hamilton. Brian, good morning. How are you?
Hi, how are you, Rick?
I'm good. I guess the question is, why now? Why announce your retirement this year?
I don't know. It just seemed right. To start the year, I talked to my wife and I thought it probably would be my last year. And to be honest, I've probably had the best group of guys I've ever had to work with. And my feeling didn't really change throughout the year, even though we were having a very successful season. So you add it all up, I think it just felt right. And no regrets. I've enjoyed every minute I've been there, and I think time's just right to do some other things.
So what are the things do you have planned?
Well, as you can imagine, I mean, I've been at Mohawk for 18 and I coach 9 at the high school level as well. So over 27 years from the months of September to March, it wraps you up. And I'm a pretty big sports fan. So there's lots of things I haven't experienced that I'd like to over that time period. Football, basketball, different things I'd like to get to. I'm also a couple years away from being senior amateur golf age, and I'd like to get a little bit more competitive in that area as well. So gives me about a year and a half here to try and put some time and effort into improving and seeing what I can do at that level as well.
What's your golf game like now?
I'm about a 5.5 handicap, and I've had it as low as 3 before. I'd like to get it back down again, but it's going to take some hard work. And like I said, it's just another area that I can compete at as you get older, and I'm excited for a new challenge.
Was this a difficult decision? You mentioned you thought about it very early on in the season leading up to the start of the season. Did you sway at all during the year to say, you know what, I still want to do this, or yeah, you know, I'm comfortable and confident that this was the right decision? What was that back and forth like?
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a lot of back and forth. Like I said, it's something going into the year I thought was probably going to be the case. And there was nothing throughout the year, even though it was as good as it was and how great the people were. It didn't change. So I just figured that it was the right decision.
Our guest on Good Morning Hamilton on 900 CHML is Brian Jonker, head coach, or I guess retiring head coach of the men's basketball team at Mohawk College. Career highlight has got to be the national championship.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with you there. And in fact, it's today is the 11-year anniversary, so it happened on St. Patrick's Day. I mean, you get to the pinnacle of your sport. That's definitely a highlight. I mean, all the different people that I've been fortunate to be around over the years is truly what coaching is all about. But as far as a singular moment, yeah, the national championship would have to rate at the top of the list.
What do you remember most about that team, and what made that club special?
The togetherness, the group itself was, they still are close. You know, we still communicate as a group on a regular basis. Guys still come out to games, and that sort of thing was the reason I think that they were unselfish and they just enjoyed being around each other. And I remember mid-February, I remember it like it was yesterday, walking around a practice, and there was a different feel in the gym that day. And as I walked around, and do you feel it? And we never lost another game the rest of the year. And it was a special group, very special.
What do you think you're going to miss the most about coaching?
Two things, I think. Number one, the relationships. I mean, being around the guys, getting to know people, and then the competition itself. I think if you could just beam me into games, I would still be interested in doing it. But obviously, the challenge of coaching and building groups and the togetherness of it all doesn't allow for that sort of thing without the time and the effort put in away from the games. But The competition and obviously the being around the guys are the two things I'll miss most.
I think it's one thing that most people don't really realize is, you know, when you're a head coach of a team, whether it's basketball, volleyball, you name the sport, it's not just coaching at that time. It's the practices. It's meeting with players. It's, meeting with coaches, other individuals connected to the team, like the training staff. This is really a full-time job.
Yeah, and at our level in the OCAA, it has to be our second job. We're not full-time coaches, so we put in, especially in that six-month window, you're putting in, you're at the gym probably 6 days a week in some capacity, and then in the off-season, you're recruiting and doing other things too that take up time. But yeah, it's not just the game, and that'll be, if it was, that would be, I'd still be doing it, I think.
How much better is the game of basketball now compared to when you first entered the coaching ranks?
Well, I mean, the athletes are bigger, stronger, faster. The focus of the game itself is different. It's become more of a fast-paced three-point game, which I'm all right with. I was always that type of player myself. And when I coached at the high school level, you know, 20 years ago, we were running around Ontario shooting threes all the time. So, but it's, as far as the athletes themselves, I mean, I've sat with the coaching staff just watching our warm-ups and watching every guy on the team dunk and do different things that, you know, when I played 30 years ago, it was a big deal if somebody dunked. Now it's the entire warm-up is dunks and there's games and the athletes are so good.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal when a player can't dunk. It's like, what's wrong with this guy?
Yeah.
But he probably has a bunch of other skill sets that adds to his team, that is for sure. Brian, yeah. Appreciate your time today. Congratulations on a marvelous career at Mohawk. And best of luck with the golfing career. That's exciting.
All right. Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it.
That is Brian Jonker, head coach, former head coach of the men's basketball team at Mohawk College. What an illustrious career, not only as a coach, but a player as well. He reached the highest heights in his particular sport.
Thanks for listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday mornings from 5:30 to 9 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
The Good Morning Hamilton podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your favorite podcast. I'm Rick Samprin. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure you rate and review.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.